The 100 Years' War, the Du Guesclin period. New King, Charles V of France. Well, Charles V of France was 26 years old when he ascended to the throne. He was a handsome man, but physically weak. An obscure illness which had struck him about 5 years before his ascension to the throne had left him thin, pallid, and sickly for the rest of his life, and his poor health necessarily affected his style of kingship. He traveled very little, passing almost all of his time in Paris and the Île-de-France. Unable to wield a weapon at 30 or ride a horse at 40, Charles could not cut that classic figure of a king. He made up for his physical disabilities by the strength of his personality, his formidable intellect, and his astute choice of subordinates, none of them strong points in his father or grandfather. Charles had learned from politics in the hard school of the Civil War of the 1350s. He did not have his father's openness nor chivalrous instincts, nor his respect of the agreements which had served their purpose. Quote, "You will find the new king a good friend and brother, a man to nourish your goodwill and stay within your peace," quote, the Counts of Tankerville wrote to Edward III at the beginning of the new reign. But Charles had never been enthusiastic about the treaties with England. He had had almost no part in making them. There is little doubt that he nursed from the outset of his reign an ambition to avenge the defeats of Crecy and Poitiers and reverse the position of France affected at Brittany and Calais. Not long after Tankerville wrote his letter, Charles' principal secretary, Gontier de Bagneux, candidly discussed his master's ambition in a confidential interview with the Count of Foix. "The new king," the secretary said, "intended to bring an end on his own terms to the vendetta between the crown and the King of Navarre and the civil war in Brittany. Then as soon as he had brought the hostages, or at least the most important ones of them, back to France, he would turn on the English in alliance with the Scots to recover what they had lost and finally destroy them." Charles was already considering the possibility of fomenting rebellions against the Prince of Wales' authority in Gascony. These exchanges, which the Count of Foix repeated to the King of Navarre, Pyrenean Garden, as an English spy listened from behind the walls, may have gained something in the telling, as most spies' reports do. But as a statement of Charles' long-term plans, it was substantially accurate and borne out by everything that he subsequently did. One of the first and most significant acts of the new reign was the investiture of the king's younger brother Philip with the Duchy of Burgundy, in accordance with his father's wishes. The immediate effect of this act was to make the breach with the King of Navarre irreparable. In other circumstances, it might have been wise to leave the previous ambiguous situation alone, for Charles V's act only recognized reality on the ground. During the summer of 1364, there was a general assault on the surviving strongholds of the King of Navarre and on the independent garrisons in western France, which were the main sources of recruits for his armies. At the beginning of July 1364, Bertrand de Guesclin invaded the Cantine with an army composed largely of Bretons who had been with him at Coquerel. Within a few days, they had captured the most important town, Fallanges, the largest of the peninsula and the hub of its road system. Not long afterwards, Barfleur, the main harbor after Cherbourg, fell to them. A second army, commanded by the Marshal of Normandy and the Royal Bailie of Bessines, conducted a successful sweep through Lower Normandy before laying siege to the great fortress of Auchefour, west of Argenton. This place, which was commanded by an English renegade clergyman, was believed to contain the largest Anglo-Navarrese garrison in the region. It eventually surrendered on terms after its walls had been wrecked by persistent mining and some 3,000 rocks had been hurled at them by siege engines. A third force, recruited mainly in Upper Normandy and Picardy, and commanded by two old veterans, Mouton de Benville and the Admiral of France, Baudrin de la Huss, began to operate simultaneously in the valley of the Eure. On July 26, 1364, these men laid siege to the Navarrese capital at Evreux. Yet another army, probably larger than any of them, was collected at Vernon on the Seine by Jean Baudricourt and the young Duke of Burgundy. This group, comprising men from the Île-de-France, Paris, and Burgundy, with 200 Gascon retainers of the lords of Albert and Pommiers, carried out a rapid sweep of the Routier garrisons, blocking the roads between Paris and the Loire. These were the largest coordinated military operations conducted by the French crown since 1356. The key to the government's new self-confidence was money. Ironically, the last legacy of the feckless old King John II, the aides and the gabel de sel, the salt tax, had been collected every year throughout the provinces of Languedoc ever since John II had first imposed them by decree in December of 1360. Although they were intended to pay the ransom of Bretagne and were only jurisdictionally justified on that basis, they provided a flow of cash, much of which was in practice diverted to the war expenditure, either at source by the communities which collected them or by the royal treasurers in Paris. An even more important source of revenue became available as a result of the decisions of the Estates General held in Amiens in November of 1363. John II's last important political act before he left for England. The Estates introduced an additional tax which was overtly designed to fund war expenditures. Called rather misleading a fouage, it was in fact a graduated direct tax designed to yield an average of 3 francs per hearth per year, less than a penny a day according to the text of the ordinance. The tax, which was intended to finance a standing army of 6,000 men, was to run indefinitely for as long as it should be required. Ultimately, it became a permanent tax, the precursor to the taille, which were to be the mainstay of the royal finances until the French Revolution. Unlike the aides and other indirect taxes, which were levied on merchandise passing through market towns, the fouage was collected in rural and urban parishes alike. No one escaped except for a very limited category of religious people and the indigent. Moreover, in another break with tradition, the fouage was voted by the Estates General on their own authority, so as to bind their constituents. It was not as grants of taxes had traditionally been, merely a prelude to a wearing round of negotiations in which the crown lost much of what it had been promised. These measures were accompanied by radical reorganization of the machinery of collecting taxes. The government adopted the system of local élites, which had originally been imposed on the crown by the Estates General after the great national crisis of 1346 and 1356, in order to take the control of tax raising out of the hands of royal officials. The élites were commissioners elected from each diocese. They supervised the local assessors to fix the contributions in the parishes and the tax farmers who bid for the rights to collect them. They were made answerable to the treasurer's general in Paris. Quality of the system was variable, but it was a great improvement on anything that had gone before. Much later, King Charles V complained that the yield of the fouage had been disappointing and sufficed to pay less than a quarter of the proposed standing army. The disappearance of almost all the financial records of the crown for this period makes it difficult to test this assertion, but it is likely to have been an exaggeration. There is evidence that very large sums were spent on warfare between 1364 and 1369, which were not raised by borrowing or coinage manipulation, the two great fallbacks of previous reigns. Indeed, the combined revenues generated by the aides, the gabel, and the fouage were enough to enable the king to start accumulating a surplus for emergencies. So as we can see, wow, things have really changed. The French king is reorganizing. He's collecting money, and he has generals who are winning, and he's going to keep doing that. So you see how important having Du Guesclin come on the scene, and then this momentary change, and everybody's focusing on, well, we have a new king, let's support him as we can, and then he reorganizes everything, even though some of these taxes will last until the time of the French Revolution. So the sources for this, Froissart's Chronicles, Perrois' 100 Years' War, Nyland's 100 Years' War, and Sumption's 100 Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.